Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. By now, you all have figured out that this podcast is all about talking to experts in overlooked fields. Fields that we all kind of naturally assume we already know everything about. Fields of expertise we take for granted. I'm guilty of this myself. When choosing guests for the show, I have a tendency to go for the obscure, the weird, but not often those we take for granted. So today, I wanted to pull the camera back a bit and shine some light on a topic most of us deal with every single day. Something you might have already used today. A few times. Cheese. Amelia Dalbero is a cheesemonger who calls herself the CEO of Cheese Talk, and for good reason. Her videos discussing the history of cheese, the types of cheese, the evolution of cheese, and, of course, the consumption of cheese, have fascinated millions of people around the world. She has the kind of passion and deep knowledge about the subject that, after watching a few of her videos, will have you reevaluating your kitchen and wondering if you have space for a miniature cheese cave. Now listen, I don't often put a warning up at the front of the show, but I'm going to do so this time. Do not, under any circumstances, listen to this interview on an empty stomach. Here's Amelia Dalbero. Amelia Dalbero, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited we finally connected. I have been mildly obsessed with your social media for a very long time now, ever since I saw you cutting apart a wheel of Alp Blossom, which is this cheese with flowers all over it.
Yeah, beautiful. Yes. Beautiful cheese.
Yeah, as soon as I saw that video, I texted all of my friends that video and I said, this is pretty much the summation of my bucket list. This is now the entirety of my bucket list as I want to eat this cheese. So thank you so much for being here.
Of course. Did you ever get to eat the cheese?
No, I don't know where to go get that cheese. I would be happy to recommend
some places in your area.
I was going to say, didn't you say like there's not that many Alp Blossom? Anyways, we're getting ahead of ourselves. For folks who have not seen your Alp Blossom, your videos, or your content in any kind of way, tell people who you are and what it is that you do.
So I'm Amelia. I am a professional cheesemonger in the New York metro area. I'm a certified cheese professional, and I open big cheese wheels on TikTok and tell you about them.
I love to talk to people and kind of overlooked fields that people think they already know everything about. And I feel like cheese is one of those things that people feel like they get, you know, get it from a cow, absolutely. Sometimes a goat. And then you go to Kroger and you get a big block of it and you eat it with chili. Like you feel like you get cheese, and everybody does cheese. Every culture everywhere has a cheese that they do. I feel like it's one of the great uniting things. But how do you go from a person?
If not cheese specifically, some kind of a dairy product or like a fermented dairy product.
How do you go from I stock pre-packaged blocks of Kraft at my local Kroger to I'm slicing up Alp Blossom by the pound? Like, how do you go to there? How do you get where you are?
People actually ask me that question all the time, and my answer is always the same, by accident. I tell them that we have kind of a little joke in the cheese industry that if you've made it this far, you kind of end up in the cheese industry. Like, I don't know a lot of people that have made it to this point purposefully. You just kind of like something happens to you in your life and you end up in this industry. And then most of us don't leave because we love it so much, because the community is so wonderful. And this is something that you do because you believe in it and you love it. It's not something that you do because there's a ton of money in it. So it's really a matter of passion.
I would like a few more details on I accidentally became a cheesemonger. How did you become a cheesemonger?
So I was working as an events coordinator for like a marketplace when I was fresh out of college, like little baby, 21 years old. And I worked in the events department for this company for a couple of years. And then there was an incident involving a pig head and some vegans. And I'm actually not allowed to really talk about it much more. But I decided that I wanted to become a butcher because I'm a spiteful and petty person. And I said, you know what, my next move in the food industry is I'm going to learn how to be a butcher because I'm, you know, I've been working in an office for a couple of years and it's fun, but I want to learn how to do a craft and I want to learn how to work with my hands. And I've worked with so many, on a real note, like it was because I had worked with so many incredibly talented people, like artisans, butchers, cheesemongers, pasta makers, like people who just love what they do and they have like mastered an art form of some kind. And I said, I would love to learn butchery. But because I was a little 22-year-old girl who had only ever worked in an office, there was not a butcher shop who would hire me with no knife skills. And rightfully so. I do not blame them for that. So the advice I was given was go work for a cheese counter, learn some knife skills. It's a little bit lower stakes. And then once you've kind of mastered that, you can go and work for a butcher counter or a butcher shop. And then I ended up loving cheese so much that I never left. And that was like almost 6 years ago. And wow. Now here I am. And I have done some butchery. I have, I made hundreds and hundreds of sausages during the pandemic. But
I feel like we all learned a lot of new skills in the pandemic. I don't make nearly as much banana bread as I did during the pandemic. I make really good banana bread though, and I was making it like twice a week for some reason. I don't know. I think it's very easy.
The shop where I work now, the customers are so lovely. I have never had customers that were like as kind and patient and like genuinely interested in what we do as they are. And during the pandemic, there was this one person who would bring every different department a warm, like fresh out of the oven, freshly baked banana bread a couple of times a week to like thank us for being there and for being open to feed the community. So that was very kind. But I did eat a lot of banana bread in the first few months of the pandemic.
We really did. One of the things I appreciate about your platform is how much time you spend dispelling misinformation about cheese, which I did not realize. Misinformation there was about cheese in the world. I kind of figured like we got cheese down, which is really why I wanted to have you on the show, because I was like, I am bereft of cheese knowledge.
That's a good word.
So what kinds of misinformation do you hear out in the world? What kinds of misconceptions do people have about cheese?
Oh, that's a great question.
Thank you so much.
I would like to preface this by saying that American cheese culture has only existed for a few hundred years. And not American cheese, as not as in Kraft slices, but the making of cheese in America, any cheese. Whereas cheese culture in the rest of the world has existed for thousands of years. So we're fairly new on the scene. And the Industrial Revolution did not help us. That did not help our cause. So there are a lot of American producers that are making absolutely incredible products that rival classic European cheeses. So one of the things that I like to tell people is that American cheese is not just Kraft singles. There are hundreds of absolutely beautifully well-made, responsibly made American cheeses that are either what we call American originals. So it's a recipe that was completely made up by that producer, or they're based on classic European or really anywhere in the world, classic cheese recipes. So I encourage you to expand your horizons. And instead of saying, I'm only going to eat French brie, maybe try a brie style from Vermont. Let's say a Moses Sleeper or a Mount Alice. And you might find that some of your new favorite cheeses come from American producers, because these artisan producers, people who make what we call real cheese, a lot of them have trained over in Europe and have done years and years of research. In Wisconsin, we have what they call master cheesemakers, which is a title that I think takes 30 years to earn. Don't quote me on that. I could be wrong about that. But there's a huge cheese culture, no pun intended, pun a little bit intended, here in the United States that most people have absolutely no idea exists, because, you know, they're so focused on grocery store block cheddar, which is kind of an entirely other conversation that I don't really want to get into when it comes to like the class system and who has access to what types of food, which is something that we're trying to even out a little bit. But if you are interested in trying some really wonderful American cheese, any Kroger grocery store should have a lot of great options, Whole Foods, or even better, if you have access to a specialty cheese shop or a specialty cheese counter, go talk to your local cheesemongers. We love chatting. A lot of people are afraid to talk to us because they think we're going to judge them. And that's absolutely not the case. I love telling people about cheese. I love answering questions. We're very friendly people. So your local cheesemonger is going to be a really good resource.
So I know that you've spent a lot of time on your social media, you know, kind of, you know, taking some of the fear out of certain kinds of terms. I know that there was some video that you did, or a few videos that you did in a row about like cheese that has ammonia on it or in it, around it, something like that, that people were freaking out about, the various kinds of rinds, whether you eat them, you don't, and that kind of thing.
That's a big question. There's a lot of misinformation about whether or not you can eat the brie rind. Mm-hmm. You can eat the brie rind. It's made
Because I always have, and I didn't know you weren't supposed to.
So a lot of people think that it's wax or it's mold or something. Well, it is mold.
It's all mold.
Cheese is just controlled spoilage. Like, that's what it is.
Cheese is controlled. It's controlled spoilage.
That's what we're doing. It's a fermented product. And what's happening is that the cheesemaker or the affineur, which is the term for cheese ager, they are controlling the environment in which that cheese essentially spoils. So they're controlling that entire process and guiding it to its final destination, essentially, which is deliciousness. And it takes a lot of knowledge, and it takes a lot of skill, and it takes a lot of experience. So I like to say that, you know, cheese making and cheese aging, which is affinage is the term for that, is kind of the intersection of science and art, because you have to have a vision, but you also have the knowledge. You have to have the knowledge to be able to make it to that vision. So
what's some of the worst misinformation you've ever heard about a cheese?
Probably that the brie rind is wax. That the mimolette. Did you see my videos on mimolette, the French one? Yeah, that there are bugs that live on the rind of that cheese. And it was like this insane. I saw this insane video from some other influencer that was like, I just found out that there are bugs on this cheese. Ew. And I was like, they're called mites. They're supposed to be there. They're not like cockroaches. They're like, the French people call cheese mites le petit affineur, which means the little cheese ager, because they're so vital to the aging process for this cheese. They help produce flavor. And honestly, like, most of them don't even make it to the United States. They're kind of like brushed off or they're vacuumed off before the cheese is actually exported. I just don't really like when people do fear mongering. Less fear mongering, more cheese mongering. You know what I mean?
You need that on a sweatshirt. You're right.
It is one of those things where people think that they know everything about it, or that they can just Google something about cheese, where most of the information that I've seen on the internet that is Googleable is not accurate. which is why I do a lot of fact checking from sources that are not the internet. Like, I use books, which is crazy. I know. I have a library of like 50 different cheese books that range in production date from like the 40s to 2023. So it's important, and because all of this information changes, so it's important to fact check yourself instead of just typing it into Google. You know, ask a professional. When you have a question about architecture, you ask an architect. When you have a question about, I don't know, like every other aspect of the food industry, when website want to do an article about something, they go to a chef, they go to a butcher, they go to a sommelier. But for some reason, no one ever decides that they're going to ask a cheesemonger about cheese. They're like, yeah, we just ask a chef. It's fine. Like, cheesemongers work really, really hard and they don't get paid that much. And we deserve a little bit of respect and appreciation.
I want a quick and dirty 101 into cheese.
Okay. Like
there's a lot of terms.
There are a lot
some
of terms.
Some of them would get this podcast flagged for a content warning, like hard, soft, semi-soft, semi-hard. I don't like these. Mm. there are all sorts of other terms. They're blue, buttery, barnyardy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that was a cheese term. Barnyardy.
Yeah.
Give me a quick cheese redux. And how long did it take you to tell the difference between all of the, like, okay. And okay. Ooh. First of all, before you answer that, can you really tell the difference?
I can.
Can you? Like, can
I really
you?
Can. I really can. So part of a competition that I have competed in the past, won, and then now I work for them. Part of that competition is a blind tasting. And so we give the cheesemongers a plate that has six cheeses on it. Out of all of the cheeses in the world, we pick six of them. And we give them this plate, and they have a certain amount of time to eat each of the cheeses and then write down for us what type of milk it's made out of. Is it raw or pasteurized? What country does it come from? What style of cheese is this made in? And then identify the cheese.
I'm sorry, what's a style of cheese?
So a style of cheese would be something like a washed rind, which is that like kind of stinky orange rind on something like a Taleggio or an Epoisse, versus something that we would call a bloomy rind, which is that kind of gray, white rind on a Brie or a Camembert. So they, and you know, there's pressed, there's unpressed, like there's a lot of different cheese terms that I won't get into because they're very, very confusing. But that's one of the things that we expect, you know, mongers, real cheese mongers to be able to do is do blind tastings and identify cheeses and be able to taste nuances between cheeses of very similar styles or even the exact same cheese that has been made in different parts of the year, because summer milk tastes different than winter milk. The milk components are different. Yeah, it's very, very crazy.
Wait, so you can eat a cheese and tell me if the milk that it came from was milked in summer?
A lot of the time, yeah, I can.
That's
there
amazing.
Will be other clues that you can tell a lot about a cheese, what it's going to taste like based on what
like,
it looks like.
This cow was sick. This cow had problems. This cow had just gone through a breakup. This cow is having
not,
a bad day.
The cheesemakers are very meticulous about what quality milk gets made into cheese. There's a lot of testing that is involved, especially with, you know, with the FDA being involved as well. So if you get an American artisan cheese, chances are this is going to be some of the highest quality cheese you have ever consumed because of how meticulous they are with their sanitation standards and testing and things like that.
So for the novice, for the person who mm-hmm. listens to this interview and says, I'm going to go use some fancy terms down at the Kroger.
Yeah.
What's a good 101 entry point? Like get some terms that we could take away and be like, oh, okay, I have a functioning understanding of the basics of cheese.
Sure. I mean, we could go through like the most popular styles of cheese, like most popular cheeses, and I can tell you what kind of cheese that is. Or if you like that cheese, you should ask for a cheese in this style, something mm-hmm. like that.
Sure.
Sure. Okay, cool. We'll start with Brie. Brie is what we call a bloomy rind cheese. So if you like Brie and you would like to branch out, you could ask your cheesemonger for something bloomy. And some other options for that might be Camembert, something like that. There are also, like I said, a lot of American brie styles that are excellent. Versus if you want something really stinky, something like a Taleggio or an Apoisse from France, those are going to be the ones that have those like slimy orange rinds. They smell like feet. You could ask for something called a washed rind cheese.
See, I always think stinky cheese and I always think blue cheese. Where am I? Is that this? But that sounds like it's a very different kind of thing.
Blue is like its own category.
It's
like
its own thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of different kinds of blue as well. But normally when cheesemongers say like a stinky cheese, we're talking about that washed rind. And it's called that because it is literally washed or brushed in some kind of a liquid, like a brine solution, wine, beer, cider, something like that. And essentially what's happening is that liquid and the salinity, like that the salt content, is creating an environment that is hospitable to certain bacteria and yeasts to grow and create those flavors.
I, in the very teeny tiny bit of preparation that I did for this interview, there was so many like, oh, make sure that your cheese can breathe, but make sure it can't breathe too much. Make sure it can, I'm like,
yeah,
there is a lot. I feel cheese like cheese, like we think of cheese as something that's totally just like chilling in the back of our refrigerator until the heat death of the universe. But like the more I feel like the more I dig into like the care of cheese, the more it starts making me paranoid that I'm doing all of the wrong things with cheese. Like and I feel the same way with like cast iron.
Yeah.
Like I thought cast iron was the easiest thing in the whole wide world to take care of. You just scrub it and you just make sure the bits are all off and you keep it oiled. But if you read the internet, cast iron,
that's your problem. You should never read the internet.
If you breathe the wrong way, cast iron is just going to become a rust bucket. And I'm like, I don't, am I doing cast iron wrong? Cause my cast iron doesn't do that. So okay, I'm so sorry. I kind of derailed you on the cheese. So no, we have stinky orange cheeses. Yes,
and we can totally touch on cheese care because there's a lot of misconceptions about that too. We were at Washington. What are some other ones? So cheddar. Cheddar is a really popular one, and English style cheddar and American cheddar are two very different things. And then you can have block cheddar, which is like what you would buy at the grocery store, like a Cracker Barrel or something like that, or a Cabot cheddar. The green one, that was my favorite as a kid, the Vermont Sharp cheddar from Cracker Barrel. Love it. On a Ritz cracker, elite. 10 out of 10, no notes.
It didn't even, a block of cheddar cheese doesn't even make it to a cracker in this house. We will just, my husband and I will just slice stand there in the kitchen, just eating it.
Yeah, totally. So if you like cheddar, if you like sharp cheddar, you want to branch out a little bit, you could ask for a cloth-bound cheddar if you want. Or you can just ask for another block cheddar, but let's say one that is from, you know, an artisan producer like Shelburne Farms or Cabot. Cabot is a cooperative. So
what does sharp mean? And I feel like sharp is a fake. I feel like it's fake. I feel like
it's not fake. It is real, but it is not. It does not mean what everyone thinks it means. Okay. So sharp does not mean intense flavor.
That's what I thought. Actually, I was like, there is no way, because these all taste the same to me.
It's fine. It's because Big Cheddar has done an excellent job of marketing that term, and good for them. But sharp actually has to do with acidity. So like when you're eating a cheddar and it's making you salivate and you feel it like right here, that's what sharp is. That being said, I will never judge someone who comes to my counter and says, I really want a sharp cheese. I want a sharp brie. Cause I know in that moment what they're asking me for. They want one that has a really
bold,
big flavor, intense flavor.
Bold cheese.
Totally get it.
I want that cheese to taste orange.
That's totally valid. And the way that I approach salesmanship is that even if you are so wrong, as long as I understand what you're saying and I can get you what you want and we can complete that transaction effectively, you're not wrong, because you've effectively conveyed your needs to me. We've communicated and you left with something that you like. So it doesn't matter if you, my job is to know about the cheese. Your job is to know about your taste. And my job is to take that information, use my knowledge and get you what you want. Any cheesemonger who tells you otherwise is a pretentious douche. Do I like the opportunity to educate? Absolutely. But there's no right or wrong answer as long as you are eating something that you like.
I would be the worst person at your counter. I would sit there and point to every single cheese and I'd be like, what is that?
That's my job.
Why is that?
You would be my favorite customer because I get really bored otherwise.
Okay. You know, you did touch on this, but I do want to actually ask about it. There is a level of elitism when it comes to cheese, wine, a few things that I feel like anything that we would consider the food of the poor, like 500 years ago, has now become the food of the rich somehow.
Like, it's so funny how that happens,
I'm just a little guy and I've got my little bit of bread and wine and cheese just getting by. And like a little bit of bread and wine and cheese is like an entire.
That's a meal. I eat that for dinner all the time.
Yeah. But like, that's like, I feel like I have to be rich to know about bread and know about cheese and know about wine.
Absolutely
like,
not.
So where's this
coming
from?
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
When you eat that stuff, are you enjoying it?
Most of the time,
are you having a good time?
Yeah.
Are you nourishing your body with food and nutrients?
I mean, maybe.
Those are the only two prerequisites. Cheese doesn't know how much money is in your bank account.
I might be overnourishing it sometimes because you get going and suddenly the bread is gone and you're like, I've made a mistake.
I totally get it. Yeah, I tell people that all the time. Cheese has no idea how much money's in your bank account. Cheese doesn't know if you have a 401k. Cheese doesn't know what kind of car you drive. Like, whatever is happening is between you and the cheese. And I do this bit in my classes. It's true. I do this bit in my classes where I talk about how certain cheeses are going extinct. And that's just kind of a fact. They're, you know, young people are not super keen on doing manual labor and doing farming and doing shepherding. Like, we are having a Manchego crisis right now. I'm so sorry to tell you guys,
really?
Manchego's in danger. Yeah. Because, you know, of all of the other things in any other part of the world that they could do. So young people are not super keen on following in their parents and grandparents' footsteps and producing cheese. So in our lifetime, we are going to see a lot of classic, beautiful, iconic cheeses. Like, the people who make them are going to die. Like, that's just kind of the fact of life. And those cheese recipes may or may not die with them. And the best way for you to support these people and keep these recipes alive is to buy the cheese. Cheese was not invented for rich people to have parties. Cheese was invented as a way to preserve nutrients in milk outside of refrigeration and use that preservation method, turn it into cheese. And it was made for people who do manual labor to nourish their bodies. That's it. The cheese was originally a food for poor people or people who were doing labor. And it has unfortunately turned into quite the opposite of that. And I think that we need to educate people on the history of it and where it came from. And we need to take it back because so many people, they shy away from it. They deny themselves deliciousness because they think it's too fancy for them or they're not good enough for it or something like that. And it's absolutely not true. If you would like to enjoy cheese, please, I'm literally begging you, enjoy as much cheese as you want.
I have gone to make myself a little charcuterie, a little cheese board. Yeah. And I have spent a lot of money, a lot. Mm-hmm. Before. And then I've also not spent money. How does somebody that's like on a budget, how do they reach out of a block of cheddar and go, totally. What do you recommend? Where do people go? How do they get the goodness of cheese if we're still on a little budget?
Yeah. So that's a great question. I get that question all the time because a lot of like fancy cheese can be really
so
price
expensive.
Prohibitive. Yeah. My job is a buyer. So my job is to kind of research all of the products and then curate a selection of cheese and charcuterie for my counter. And one of the things that I'm very, very sensitive about is making sure that we have a range of price points, because not everyone can walk in and say, I would like a pound of Stichelton, which sells for $43 a pound, which is insane. So I always good? Like to have, oh yeah, it's delicious. Shout out to Joe Schneider. He's doing a great job. But I like to have a range of products at a variety of price points so that anyone in any economic situation can come into my shop and leave with something that they are excited to eat. I have cheese that goes from $10 a pound to $75 a pound. And it's my job and my staff's job to be able to help you navigate all of that and take all of your needs and wants into consideration and what your budget is and be able to provide you with a variety of products or, you know, how, whatever you want to be able to get you that, stay within your budget and make sure that you're satisfied. So being a cheesemonger is just as much about salesmanship and really like empathy as it is about knowing the difference between pasteurized and raw milk.
What are a few cheeses that you recommend somebody try if they do want to branch out a little bit? What are some that are typically a little less costly? Yeah. Or are there particular brands that are a little less costly or something?
I would say if you like stinky cheese, you can try just a Taleggio. Those are usually pretty cheap. And then a lot of block cheddars will kind of hover between the like $10 to $20 a pound area. Those are usually American ones, but I would recommend definitely trying an American block cheddar. You can try some goat cheese. There's some really good fresh goat cheese out there. Vermont Creamery makes goat cheese logs that usually sell from anywhere between $5 and $7 a piece. The best place to go, I would say, is a cheesemonger. Like, go talk to your local cheesemonger. They can help you figure it out. If you don't have access to a local cheesemonger, which I understand that a lot of people do not, you can go to your local grocery store. So something, again, like a Whole Foods or a Kroger. A lot of Kroger stores have Murray's counters in them now, or even Trader Joe's and Aldi. Like, Aldi has lines of cheese that are what we call private label, which are American artisan producers that are making that cheese, and Aldi is slapping their own logo on it. And that is a totally...
Aldi yeah. saves my butt every time I go there yeah. and get their Winking Owl for like $2.30. A bottle, and then I will go get some cheese.
Aldi is a good Aldi and Trader Joe's are good options for finding new cheeses. And that being said, you don't have to have Marcona almonds, or you don't have to drink a $50 bottle of wine with your cheese. One of the things that
for $50, I can get a lot more wine. Get a lot more wine.
Listen. If you want to eat, let's say a Jasper Hill Harbison, which is like a $25 piece of cheese, if you would like to take that and you want to dip Flamin' Hot Cheetos right in that Harbison, which is like kind of like a brie, if you want to dip Flamin' Hot Cheetos in there and that is delicious to you, I support you wholeheartedly.
I cannot anything that you could dip Flamin' Hot Cheetos into that would not continue to be delicious.
Exactly.
It has a weird enough sweet, sour, savory, spicy flavor mm-hmm. profile. It's just good with everything.
Yeah, they're so good. And something I like to tell people about pairing is that there are no rules. You can eat cheese with literally whatever you want. I won first place in the pairing portion of a competition that I did for a pairing that involved a pizza flavored Pringle. So, like, I do this for a living. I'm eating cheese with pizza Pringles. Don't let anybody tell you that you can't do that. Don't let anybody tell you that you can't eat cheese with literally anything you want.
Okay, where should I be keeping my cheese? Because I've seen videos where you have like a
little
fancy,
box.
Yes,
yes,
like a little box.
House. Yes. I do love the little cheese house, the cheese brado.
You have fancy
That's a very
rocks that go in there
storage
and
concept.
Like, yes. yeah. Because I just wrap it in plastic wrap and shove it in the back of my fridge in the drawer, in that cheese drawer, and just kind of hope for the best.
So that is on one end of the cheese storage spectrum. I love the cheese grotto, but that is something that I would recommend using for a cheese that you are going to eat in the next couple of days that you would like to keep at room temperature, as like the French people do, which is great. The thing about the cheese grotto is that it has really high humidity, and store and cheese loves humidity. It keeps it healthier longer.
Is that like a brie?
That being said, like we want to keep brie warmer. Yes. It depends on the style of cheese, but generally cheese likes between like 70 and 95% humidity. And your fridge does not have that humidity that high generally, unless you have like some sort of a special fridge. But not everyone can afford something like a little house where your cheese lives. And I totally understand that. So I have some little tips and tricks that I like to give people. Specially made cheese paper is excellent. So if you buy cheese at a cheese shop, chances are they're going to give your piece of cheese to you wrapped in some sort of cheese paper. And normally these are coated on the inside. They're specially sealed so that it allows the cheese to breathe, but it doesn't dry it out, and it maintains that level of humidity inside that paper. So however long it takes you to eat that cheese, cut off your little portion, put it back in that cheese paper, put it back in your fridge. They also make cheese bags that are made out of the same material, but instead of having to like figure out how to wrap your cheese up like a little present, you just boop, pop it in a bag, seal it, and put it back in your fridge. If you make friends with your cheesemonger, if your cheesemonger is a lovely, nice person, you can totally ask them to give you an extra piece or two of cheese paper. If let's say you're buying a piece of cheese, like a block of cheddar, out of what we call a grab and go case, and it's wrapped in plastic. Just go to your cheesemonger and say, I would love a piece of cheese paper to wrap this in when I get home, and that'll keep it fresher longer. Cheese and plastic wrap are enemies. They don't like each other, and not many people know that. And it's also not a life and death situation. Like, your cheese isn't going to spoil and become dangerous if you keep it in plastic wrap. Again, there are so many things that people will say are like hard and fast rules that are just not. Like, you can totally put your cheddar in a piece of plastic wrap and put it in your fridge for a week. And it might not taste the best, but still edible, still food. You can still eat it.
I have no idea any of these things existed, and they're about to become my entire personality. I'm going to go get cheese paper.
It's totally fine. And if you don't have access to cheese paper or you can't afford it, again, plastic wrap, totally fine. You can also use wax or parchment paper as a substitute. But my biggest piece of advice for keeping cheese long in your fridge is don't. Like, I tell people, buy less cheese more often. So instead of buying a pound piece of Parmigiano, buy a quarter pound. And then when you finish that, just go get another one. And
my husband is going to be really happy about this advice, because it means I get to eat. Yeah. We get to eat more cheese. We get to eat just more cheese. Yes.
Right. And what that does is instead of you using the same piece for 2 weeks, you're getting a new piece every so often. And chances are wherever you're getting it from, your shop, your grocery store, is moving through that cheese faster than you are. So if you are buying a new piece every couple of days, you're getting a fresher product. And that's going to preserve the flavor. It's going to preserve the quality. And then if you're buying smaller pieces of cheese, you get to try a larger assortment of cheeses.
Okay. What are some things that cheesemongers judge one another on, like in their own shops? Ooh. Like, okay. And I ask this. So I did see a video of yours where you were like giving advice and instructions on things like a mirror finish with the wrap or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, that. So what are some things that like you're in a cheese shop and you're like, I don't know about that. Or, oh, good for you.
So I will preface this by saying that the cheese community is overwhelmingly supportive of one another. I very rarely come across cheesemongers that have beef with one another. And if they do, it usually has something to do with something outside of cheese itself. But there are, like, if I go into a shop, there are some standards that I hold my own staff to, that if I see that not happening in that shop, I may or may not buy that particular cheese. Glass wrapping is something that we do, which refers to wrapping a piece of cheese in plastic wrap so tightly and neatly that it doesn't actually look like it's wrapped in anything. And that not only does it look neat, and it looks appetizing, but it also helps keep the cheese better longer because it helps keep the air out so the cheese doesn't dry out. Something else that I always look at in cheese counters is surface mold. So I can tell how long your cheese has been in that case based on how much mold is on what we call the face of the cheese, or the part of the cheese that you can see. When you open a cheese, you can see that inside part, and that's what we call the face. So if your cheese is growing mold on the face and it's covered in it, I know that you have not touched that in weeks. So something that I am kind of a stickler about at my counter is what we call facing cheese. And that means just kind of taking off that mold, keeping it healthy. And it's a little bit more complicated. It's, you know, we're keeping that cheese clean and healthy, but we're also trying to move it and sell it at a certain rate so that whoever's buying it is getting the best possible piece. I don't really want to sell someone a piece of cheddar that's been sitting in my case for 3 months. That just, I would feel bad charging them full price for that. And I personally, as a consumer of cheese, I would not want to eat that. So you just have to be really mindful of the rate at which you sell certain cheeses. Some of them are sturdier than other ones. Soft cheeses obviously have to be sold faster than hard cheeses. So there's a lot of mental math that happens as well.
There are a million little tools that you could potentially buy to serve your cheese, to cut your cheese. Are any of them better? Are any of them worth getting? Or is it all, could I just use a butter knife for everything?
You could. You absolutely could.
Okay, the look on your face just said, no, the hell, keep that butter knife away from that.
Listen, I'm always mindful of the advice that I give people based on their financial situation.
I understand. But if I want one thing,
I would say, aside from cheese paper and like those special bags, I would say get a soft cheese knife. Because
Is that the little one with the curvy?
Okay. So here's my reasoning behind this. Everyone loves brie, right? It's like everyone on the internet is like, oh my God, brie, baked brie, whipped brie, brie
Larson.
Board. Yeah. Whatever. And so often I see these influencers like trying to cut grocery store brie with like a chef knife and having so much trouble with it. And they're like, well, just freeze it first. Please don't ever freeze your cheese. Never freeze your cheese. It will never be the same. That is one of
cheese. Why would you freeze cheese?
I'm normally very low key and I'm like, there's no hard and fast rules. Don't freeze your cheese. Not because like you'll get smited, but just because it's going to kind of taste like crap afterwards. You'll never get the original texture back. That being said, if you love brie and you would like a better way to serve it, use a soft cheese knife. So we have something like this. It's a little teeny tiny blade, little guy. And the reason being is the softer the cheese, the smaller the knife. Less surface area for the soft cheese to stick to because it is a very sticky cheese. If you try to cut like ripe brie with a chef knife, you're gonna have to like peel it off the blade. Uh-huh. It's gonna get stuck on there. It's just gonna be a mess. So you're gonna use one of these guys.
Is it?
Nope. Cheese knives are usually not serrated. This particular one that I have is a little bit serrated. This is my favorite kind of cheese knife here.
I like that so much.
So same concept, not a lot of surface area. This is like a soft or a blue cheese knife because it has a blue handle. This particular brand color codes their knives, which is very cool. So like blue cheese, blue handle, washed rind cheese, sticky cheese, red handle, that kind of thing. But you can use it for anything. So I like this one because it has these holes in the middle to prevent cheese from sticking to the blade. And then it also has these little prongs on the top so that you can, once you're done cutting your cheese, you can just pick it up and, you know, serve it or place it or do whatever you need to do. So this is super lightweight, and you can get these online on, you know, at your local restaurant supply store, or this one is from Bosca. I don't like to tell people to go on Amazon, but again, accessibility, if you want to buy it from Amazon, go ahead. So that's going to, if you love brie and you love cutting brie and you're cutting camembert, these are going to be game changers for you.
Okay. What's the little knife that comes in the charcuterie kit that you bought? Like, what's that little thing? Is that anything?
So that is a knife that you would use for chunking, which is the official term. And that's something that you would use for harder cheeses like Parmigiano, Gouda, some aged cheddars. And because texturally, those cheeses are a lot more interesting if you're doing like really rustic chunks of them, rather than just little slices or cubes or something like that. And it just looks a little bit better. But what that knife in particular is most used for, on a larger scale, they're like, you know, that big. There is a set of three different shapes of knives that you use to open wheels of Parmigiano. And it's that knife, the spade, the key, which has a little hook on the end of it that you use to score the rind of the Parmigiano, and then the stiletto, which is this guy here. And you use all of those together to open wheels of Parmigiano rather than trying to like cut through it with a double handle knife, which is just, you're going to get hurt if you try to do that. So traditionally that's what you would use to open those wheels, which range in weight from 75 or 80 pounds to the heaviest wheel I've ever gotten was 103 pounds. And I opened it on Saturday and it was real greasy. And we did it on the street in the rain. It was like a cutthroat kitchen episode. They were like, this is the heaviest wheel of cheese you've ever opened. We're going to give you the ricketiest table you've ever seen. There's going to be children running around in front of you. Also, you're outside and it's raining and the table is on a slope.
Why did we do this to ourselves?
It was a nice little demo for, it was for a community organization that wanted to highlight small businesses. And so every business was supposed to put on a demo. But I will say that I killed that, and it was one of the finest farm cracks of my entire career, and that I was very, very proud of my work in that environment. So
what's your favorite cheese?
Parmigiano Reggiano.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, that's why I have the Parm knife tattoo.
People's relationship with Parmesan tends to be the grated stuff in a green tube.
Yes. What,
how should we reintroduce ourselves to Parmigiano Reggiano? So,
love this question.
Thank you.
Parmesan is not the same as Parmigiano Reggiano. Yes, shocking. I know.
What?
That being said, Parmesan is not an inherently bad product. I refuse to shame people for consuming Parmesan. However, if you would like to try the real deal, the authentic historic recipe.
Wait, so what's Parmesan? Has been made,
Parmesan, we'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. Parmigiano Reggiano DOP is the official name for this cheese, and DOP means protected designation of origin in Italian, so PDO. This means that the cheese, the production and sale and marketing of this cheese is regulated by a government organization called a consortium. And the reason for that is to promote authenticity and guarantee quality and make sure that when you buy Parmigiano Reggiano DOP, you are getting a product of historic origin. You are getting the highest quality version of this product. Because it is regulated by the government, by law, it cannot be made outside of that one region in Italy and still called Parmigiano Reggiano DOP. So that's where Parmesan came from. People, it's because it's so delicious and so widely consumed and so widely loved, they started making imitation versions of it, which some of them are very low quality, and some of them are just different. But if you are not in the what we call the area of designation, in Emilia-Romagna and like one province outside of Emilia-Romagna, and you are not making your cheese with the milk of a specific breed of cow and aging it for a specific period of time, and after 12 months the consortium is going to come in and like tap your cheese wheels with a little hammer, like you're getting your reflexes tested at the doctor, and they're going to listen to it and say, oh no, that sounds good, or oh no, that doesn't sound good, there's defects in this wheel. If you are not making your cheese according to those standards, you have to call your cheese Parmesan.
I
know, this is mind
desperately
blowing.
I desperately want to know how I become the chancellor of cheese. Like I want my job for the rest of my life to just be going around judging your cheese. I just want to judge the shit out of your cheese. I just want to be like, listen, Shantae, you stay.
Yeah. So
this sachet away.
So what to look for if you want to make sure that you're getting the real thing, what you look for is that name, Parmigiano Reggiano DOP. And then you also look for what's called the consortium seal, which is going to be a red and yellow little round logo on the packaging of that product. And that's going to tell you that you're buying the real thing.
What are your thoughts on Velveeta?
I think the Velveeta absolutely has its place. I'm not particularly a fan, but that's just because I grew up a Kraft girly. So I just never ate Kraft macaroni, or I never ate Velveeta macaroni and cheese. I was always eating Kraft macaroni and cheese, kind of like how I'm not a big fan of Kraft American singles, not because I hate them, but because when I was growing up, I was eating Land O'Lakes American singles from the Stop and Shop deli.
Wait, Land O'Lakes has a cheese?
Yeah.
I've only ever seen their butter. I didn't know they had cheese.
Yeah. I was eating their sliced American on my sandwiches as a kid, and like Jarlsberg and the Cracker Barrel Vermont Sharp Cheddar. So I think that there absolutely is a place in the world for all of these cheeses, fake or not.
I was going to say, is it technically a cheese? Okay.
No, it's a cheese product.
That's what does it mean to be a cheese product?
The information that I was given when I was, when I was like training to be a cheesemonger and I was still learning, one of my mentors told me this, and I cannot confirm or deny if this fact is still true or if it ever was true. So again, please fact check me, that in the United States, a cheese only has to be 51% cheese, and the rest of it can be like preservatives or fillers or anticoagulants or something like that. Somebody fact check me on that. But that's why like the stuff in the green cans, your grated Parm in your green cans is shelf stable for like a year, versus when I take real Parmigiano Reggiano in my shop and we grate it fresh, I put a shelf life of a week on there. And that's
you better go make that lasagna. You better go make it right now.
But again, that kind of plays into what we were talking about of buy less cheese more often. Or if you, instead of buying a huge container of grated Parm and expecting it to last you a month, buy a quarter pound piece and grate it yourself.
That is something I did start doing a few years ago, is I do buy blocks and I grate. And I do buy less cheese more often, but it is still fairly cheap.
That personally, that's the way that I do it. Then I'm able-bodied. I can do that, but I also provide pre-grated cheese for people who are not able to do that. I like to have a lot of options. We do Parmigiano Reggiano and we do Pecorino Romano as well.
Okay. So
that's my advice. Buy less, buy fresher, buy more often.
According to an organization I didn't know existed before about 90 minutes ago, the International Dairy Foods Association.
Okay.
The most popular cheese recipe in the United States is macaroni and cheese, which should surprise no one. Because I can't think of another cheese recipe.
You mean like a grilled cheese?
Sure, or like a dip, maybe. But yeah. I don't feel like we're using real cheese when we make a dip.
No.
Okay.
We love a queso dip.
It is. I want to make the best macaroni and cheese that I've ever had in my entire life. And I want to go all out. And I will say, I did try to do this one year, many years ago, for Thanksgiving. And I used like the world winningest cheese recipe. And it had like 20 cheeses in it. It was crazy.
Yeah. Was it the the Disney World one that uses like double Gloucester.
I genuinely do not remember.
You don't need to go that far.
Sheer volume of cheese and the kinds of, I spent $76 on cheese.
Too much. You don't need to be doing that.
I remember that figure because my husband was like,
what did you do? Yeah, exactly.
Well, I said, I just bought everything on the list in the amount they told me to buy.
I would love to see this recipe.
I was upgraded to mac and cheese. I was upgraded to side dish that year for Thanksgiving. I had finally graduated from like, you can bring some soda to like, you can make a dish. So I had graduated to side dish. So I was going to prove myself. Yeah. I don't know if you know anything about Southern families, but like there's like a hierarchy in the family.
I did not know that.
Oh,
that makes sense though.
Okay, so let me explain holiday meals to you in the South. Okay, so if you are a functioning idiot, you get to bring paper plates.
Oh, great.
Like that's the bottom base level. You can bring paper plates, and we're probably going to buy some backup chinette. Because you're probably going to screw it up and not buy the chinette. You're probably going to get the cheap little flimsy white.
Yeah, yeah. The plastic ones that like just go. Yeah. They go flaccid as soon as grease hits them.
Bottom level, you've got your paper plates, you've got your napkins, you've got your cups. Just slightly above that is you can bring a beverage. Like I can trust that you're going to bring a flavor other people like, because it requires at least some thought.
Like a store-bought beverage or like your pre-batching cocktails?
No, that's way up there. And it has to be store-bought beverage because the person that makes the sweet tea is also given like kind of a place of prominence.
Okay, so that makes sense though, because good sweet tea is hard to do. I have an aunt who is from the South and I have never had sweet tea that is as good as when she makes it.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you go to semi-homemade things, rolls, you know, crescent rolls, that kind of thing, that you get to do that. Eventually you get upgraded to some side dishes, and then there's like a tier to those. Like kind
that's
of
on where the like the green bean casserole.
Your green bean casserole, your broccoli
love
cheese, your sweet potato, that kind of thing.
Sweet potato pie.
Yep. At the very tippy top level is obviously typically this is your grandmother or your grandfather, like the matriarch, the leader of the family makes the bird. They make the meat. They are in charge of the meat, and they typically are also in charge of also like the main dessert. You can also be kind of upgraded to make a dessert, but it's not the dessert. Does that make sense? Like there's multiple desserts, but there's the main dessert.
The supporting dessert.
Like you've got a piece of pumpkin pie. There's always a pumpkin
pie. There's got to be a pumpkin pie.
Correct.
Yeah, in my family, someone always did a pumpkin pie and someone always did a sweet potato pie.
Yeah. So at the very tippy top of this.
But a pecan. Like,
yeah. So eventually you graduate to I make the turkey. Mm-hmm. And so that's how you know
for that though.
No, I make the turkey now.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I make the turkey. It is a recognizing of one's skills over time, what you get to get graduated to. So there's this entire hierarchy. So anyways, I had been graduated to side dish at the time, and I was going to make macaroni and cheese. And I saw a recipe. It was on Good Morning America. And it was like, this is the world's best macaroni and cheese recipe. And I said, oh, well, that's convenient.
Okay, well, we need to
I will find the recipe. I will send it to you. But I literally spent $76 on cheese. This was not great. And the fact that I ever got to make any other dish ever again, I can't express to you how much macaroni and cheese this made. It made so much. Okay, it's your last day on Earth. You are going to make yourself some macaroni and cheese. You have an unlimited budget. Jeff Bezos handed you his checkbook and said, okay. I would like macaroni and cheese, please. What you making? What you making?
Ooh, I get this question a lot at the counter. And I always tell people you want to go for an Alpine, a cheddar, and a wild card. So an Alpine is something
only three?
Yeah, I mean, you can add other ones in if you want.
You're so cheated.
I feel like, so cheated. I bought like 20.
I've done it with one before. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to have an insane assortment of cheese, because think about it. Each of these cheeses has a very distinct personality. Mm-hmm. And if you have too many, they're all going to get overwhelmed and it's going to muddy the flavor. Mm-hmm. So I think that you have to choose like two or three really strong options and just make it work. And that's kind of like, that comes from my experience with Italian cooking, okay, so which is all about simple Alpine ingredients and letting them shine.
An Alpine, a cheddar, and a wild card.
Mm-hmm. So an Alpine is going to be something like a Gruyere or a Comté or something like that. I always go with like a younger Gruyere, somewhere around 6 or 12 months. Those are going to have high moisture content. They're going to shred and melt beautifully. So that's your Alpine. That being said, you could also, if you go to a specialty shop, you could do something like an Appenzeller or something like that. If you want a little bit of funk in your mac and cheese, raclette, Appenzeller, Vacherin Fribourgeois, anything like that. For cheddar, again, I would recommend sticking with a younger version. Something around anywhere under 12 months is good. You can use a cloth bound cheddar. I personally prefer like a block cheddar somewhere between 6 and 9 months. Sharp cheddar you could go with. Make sure it's not too sweet. There's a lot of cheddar producers that will add what we call adjunct cultures to make the cheese taste sweeter. So like if you ever have those cheddars that are like really sweet and nutty and they have those crunchy crystals, that sweetness is not going to translate well to macaroni and cheese. So try to get one that's like on the sharper side, something like that. And then for a wild card, what kind of flavor do you like? Do you like stinky? You could throw Taleggio in there. You could do raclette. Do you like truffle? Get a cheese with some black truffle.
I've never had truffle. I'm gonna
throw that in. Yeah, the wild card is your creative license. And the only thing that I would say is stay away from cheeses that are really really sweet, like aged Gouda.
So what are your three? Gouda. What are your unlimited budget? What are your unlimited budget final three?
My unlimited budget final three.
Jeff Bezos handed you his wallet and said, "Go for it." Your dream mac and cheese.
My dream mac and cheese. Gruyere, specifically yes. the Gormino Michael Speaker 12-month Gruyere Sirchois. I would also do a Shelburne cheddar, raw milk cheddar from Vermont. Excellent. Probably the 6 month or the 1 year. I like those a lot. And then my wild card. I'm going to have to go with Hollerhocker, which is Hollerhocker is an Appenzeller style cheese. It is from Switzerland. It's made by Walter Ross, who is the nicest man I've ever met in cheese. And he makes this cheese every single day, like himself, like he's in there. He himself is in the vat making this cheese with the milk from the surrounding farms in his town. And the town in Switzerland is called Tuffertville. So this is really what this is an artisan cheese. This is artisan as it gets. And it is a little bit stinky. It's a little bit nutty. There's a lot of like brown butter, like cooked leeks flavors happening in there. And I think that would be a really nice compliment to my grilled cheese. I mean, my macaroni and cheese. Hollerhocker is also amazing. Very popular in the specialty cheese community now. It's pretty widespread. So if you can find Hollerhocker, definitely give it a try. I would say that if you're looking to get into fancy cheese, and you'd like a starting point, Hollerhocker.
Well, Amelia Dalbero, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire and giving us a peek under the rind of cheese.
Yeah, why not?
Is that?
Yeah.
Sure. Do you have a, oh God, there's a million cheese puns. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a worst cheese pun you've ever heard?
Ooh. I mean, we make a lot of cutting the cheese jokes. Like it's just how it works.
Sure. And everything is Gouda.
Yeah. Like, ugh.
That joke needs to be retired.
It's funny every time.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Gouda? Really? Okay.
Like,
I am also not the person to judge your puns because I hate puns. I think puns are an important part of
any career. You have to find humor in what you do.
If folks would like to find out more about you and see your work, where can they do that?
So,
where can they find you online?
My TikTok handle is @punkrockparmigiano, like Parmigiano, like Parmigiano Reggiano, spelled the correct way. But as soon as you type in like punk rock parm, like I'll just pop up. On Instagram, if you would like to follow me on Instagram, that is EMDALBERO. So M Dalbero is just my name. And that is where I post all of my cheese related stuff, my cheese related travels, new products that I have in the shop, things that I'm excited about. So if you follow me there, you'll get the inside scoop on what I'm doing in my life, essentially. But just, you know, fun things that you may not have even known existed. Just like to, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciated it. This was a fun look.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm glad we finally got to do this after all this time.
And that's going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Emilia Dalbero. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. You could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, please consider leaving a review. Reviews are free, and they help recommend the show to other listeners just like you. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and you get to help me choose the questions for upcoming guests. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you'd like to connect with me on social media, and why wouldn't you? Social media is so fun these days. You can connect with me @headonfirepod on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, for what that's worth. Before I go, I did want to let you know, I do have some copies of my poetry collection, While I Wait to Be a God Again, available on my Etsy shop. If you are so interested, the link is going to be in the show notes for this show. I will say, by the time this comes out, they might be all sold because I had a big old order of them and they all sold within a day. So I bought more author copies because that's how this works. I have to buy my own book and then sign it and sell it to you all. So I bought a whole bunch more and they're already starting to sell. So if you are interested, if there are any left, the link will be in the show notes for this episode. So thank you all so much in advance. I really am going to go now. Thank you all so much for tuning in and downloading the show. And remember, don't freeze your cheese. Bye.